Today, our Hidden Kitchen series takes us to the remote and rugged world of Basque sheep herders in the American West. They cook outdoors in Dutch ovens buried below the ground. The Kitchen Sisters, producers Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva, call their story The Sheep Herder's Ball.
I'm John Esquaga, John Esquaga's Nugget Casino in Sparks, Nevada. We've been there 48 years. I'm a Basque, if you know where the Basque people are, from the Pyrenees. My dad was a sheep herder when he first came over, about 1900. There's a great number of Basque sheep herders in Idaho, Nevada, California, Montana, New Mexico. In fact, on the ranch where I live, I still have 75 sheep. I just want to keep my heritage going. We have a Basque restaurant at the Nugget, Orozco. That's my dad's hometown in the Basque country.
What about baking that great Basque bread?
Sure, Dutch oven. Dutch oven. If you didn't know how to make bread being a sheep herder, I don't think you'd survive. Our government had a program bringing a lot of the sheep herders over from the Basque country. They were in dire need of sheep herders because nobody wanted to herd sheep in America. That's a lonely job.
My name is Francisco Lasarte.
My name is Joaquin Lasarte.
Basque
sheep herder.
You lonely. You by yourself, 2,000 sheep and 2 dogs. 3 years, you stay there. No vacation, no day off, no holidays. You stay 24 hours close to the sheep.
We make $7 a day. They pay you only once a year.
You cook outside, mostly under the ground. You make fire. You have a Dutch oven. You can cook bread. 90% times it's lamb.
You say Basque to a Westerner and they think shepherd. In Basque country, very few people are shepherds. I'm Mark Kurlansky. I wrote a book called The Basque History of the World. Basques would go out in Western America and for the first time in their life have this huge flock of sheep over a huge expanse of land. Nobody has huge expanses of land in European Basque country.
In 1964,
came to the United States. I have a horrible life in Spain in that time because Franco, you cannot go anywhere, you cannot say anything. Only way you can came to the United States, working sheep herders. Hundreds of people like that in that time in the Franco power.
They would have a sponsor that would get them over here. They were told, go to Noriega Hotel in Bakersfield. My name is Linda Elizalde McCoy. The guys would come in off the train from Ellis Island, make their way to the West Coast. My grandmother would see to it that they were fed, and then their boss would pick them up.
I'm Bernadette Irigoyen, Noriega Hotel. I've been working here for 42 years. I have 3 brothers. They were sheep herders, and then I came to cook. Just guys, no women. I make stew and flan, blow sausage, paella, family style. A lot of Bascos.
Basque sheep herders who were seasonally laid off would spend months in a Basque hotel. The hotels took the old world Basque cuisine, things that were festive food in the Basque country, and they made it standard fare. Beef, chicken dishes, coffee. By the time the herders got down to town, he had all the lamb he'd wanted to eat for a while. William Douglas, the Center for Basque Studies, University of Nevada, Reno.
You count your sheep and you give the water. The worst part, I think, it's in the alfalfa. Because if you not take care of them, the alfalfa, a lot of sheep blow.
What do you mean they blow?
They blow. They eat. They never stop it on the gas. They blow it out. You can do huge damages.
It was very hard. 18-year-old kid who's been ripped up out of his community in Europe, and all of a sudden he's in a foreign land with a foreign language, and he's up on top of a mountain with a bunch of sheep. Amongst Basque, there's a whole vocabulary of madness. The sheep herder who goes over the edge, who becomes sagebrushed or sheeped.
It's called the Irinsi. It's a kind of a war whoop. You know, these people didn't have cell phones, and they would call from one area to another to get someone's attention.
You are listening to the Basque Hour, KBOI in Boise, Idaho, every Sunday at this hour.
My name is Rosita Alegria Artis. My mother was Espy Alegria. She had a Basque radio program that went out to the sheep herders, the voice of the Basque. They listened in their sheep camps. They had little transistors. She wished them happy birthdays, gave them the soccer scores in Basque. During the Franco years, he did suppress the language. The only place you could use it was at home in secret. She'd translate for them. If they had a problem with immigration, she did for them. They never paid her, but occasionally they would give her a lamb. We would throw it on the kitchen table and cut it up and freeze it.
The sheep herders, they organized barbecue and dance and everything. Big day for us.
I have a lot of pictures of Mom dancing at the Basque sheep herders' ball. The men wore Levi's and the women wore house dresses. An accordion, a tambourine, and somebody would play the spoons. They auctioned off a lamb. They had chorizos, Basque sausage. They have a sandwich, pork tenderloin and pimentos, hard crust bread.
I still have some memories, some good ones and some bad ones. Maybe I can sing with those two guys. Sheeper song.
Hidden Kitchens is produced by the Kitchen Sisters and mixed by Jim McKee. You can find photographs of the Sheep Herders Ball, recipes for Basque bread and lamb, and Hidden Kitchens podcasts at npr.org.
Now back to those flavonoids you mentioned, Robert. Farming experiment at the University of California, Davis has found that organically grown tomatoes are richer in these particular kinds of antioxidants than conventionally grown tomatoes. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports on one researcher who is determined to figure out exactly why that might be.
Steve Kafka stumbled upon organic gardening by accident back in the late 1960s when he was a student at UC Santa Cruz. Countercultural, anti-war sentiments were high, and there was word on campus that a bunch of students were digging out a brush-covered hillside for a new organic garden.
My girlfriend dragged me up there. I didn't want to go.
You weren't interested in farming?
No.
But something clicked that day. 40 years later, a framed photo hanging on Kafka's office wall at UC Davis shows him with a wheelbarrow at the center of the activity, running the show. He says he remembers that time well.
Yeah, well, I would have felt wonderful for doing the activity and overwhelmed because I was in charge and too young.
But it was a wonderful time.
Yeah, you could do a thing that was both a craft and intellectually satisfying and was physical.
Kafka went on to get a PhD in agronomy, and one of his latest interests is to figure out if the way we grow things can actually make food more nutritious.
Up here, you have two rows here, it'll probably be about 10,000 plants per acre.
On some fields just west of Davis, California, Kafka and his colleagues have been comparing organic and conventional tomatoes grown in neighboring plots. They've found that the organic ones have almost doubled the concentration of two types of flavonoids, which are considered to be healthy compounds with potent antioxidant activity. When we visited the site, a tractor was turning over last season's cover crops.
Today's the day.
Weird. Good time to be here, huh?
Yeah.
Over the next few days, thousands of seedling tomato plants would be transplanted here, and all of them need nitrogen to grow. Kafka explains a key difference between organic and conventional is how the tomatoes are fertilized. With the conventional plots, Kafka's team applies a commercial fertilizer.
With fertilizer, you can have as much available as you put on.
But with the organic plots, the nitrogen comes from manure and composted cover crops. These have to be broken down by the microbes in the soil before the nitrogen's released.
When you use organic materials like this, it has to go through those breakdown processes. It takes time, and it's not all instantaneously available.
So it's a slower feed?
Yeah.
With less nitrogen, the organic tomatoes may have more time to do things other than just grow, such as to make flavonoids. Kafka's theory is that this difference in how the plants are fertilized may explain why the organic tomatoes, over a 10-year period, contained 97% more camphorol and 79% more quercetin. These are two common flavonoids. It makes for a very interesting finding, especially for those who assume that organic's healthier. But Kafka says it's not so clear-cut.
There's a lot of things when you do these comparisons that can confound the results.
The soil types could be different, moisture or irrigation may vary from plot to plot, and the variety of tomatoes grown could change the picture.
Just calling something conventional organic doesn't tell you that.
Kafka says what he's trying to do is pinpoint cause and effect. If limiting the supply of nitrogen to tomatoes could consistently lead to more flavonoids, then perhaps conventional farmers could do this too. But there's much more work to do to test this theory. Kafka's personal views on eating well haven't changed much since he became a researcher. The scientist in him remains skeptical that organic food on the whole is any healthier. But the foodie in him loves to eat here.
This is a combination of a food co-op and a food kind of culture place.
At the Davis Co-op, he cruises past sticky cheeses, specialty meats, and rows of bright-colored produce.
Purple, everything's purple. Purple asparagus.
You eat it all.
Yeah.
And love it all?
Yeah, sure.
Kafka says he's got friends who farm organically, and he likes buying their food to support their way of life.
I think acting in ways that you find consistent with some good principle, how can that be bad?
But he says the research is important, too. It can save us from our biases and help tease apart the consequences of different ways of growing food. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
And did you know the label 100% natural has different meanings for cookies and, say, chicken fingers? Or that those cage-free chickens might not ever have seen the outdoors? You can find out how to decipher food labels at npr.org/yourhealth.
For NPR's Kitchen Window, I'm Bonnie Wolf. Susan Russo is a food writer in San Diego. She publishes stories, recipes, and photos on her cooking blog, Food Blogger. She also mills around local farmers markets. In early spring, she's there looking for strawberries. She wrote about what to do with them for NPR's Kitchen Window online. She joins me today from San Diego. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Bonnie.
So the strawberries look pretty good in California.
The strawberries are looking beautiful in California.
We have California strawberries in the Northeast also.
Right, I'm sure. Well, actually, that's because most of the country gets California strawberries most of the year. Apparently, we produce close to 90% of the strawberries that are eaten throughout the country.
Is that right?
Yeah. Apparently, California produces over 1 billion pounds of strawberries a year, if you can believe that.
Are they all the same kind of strawberry?
No, they aren't. Actually, there are several different varieties. I think a couple of the most popular ones are called Camarosa and Avalon, and those are grown in Oxnard, California. And that's where most of the strawberries are grown here and then just shipped throughout the country year-round.
Why is California such a good place to grow strawberries?
Well, I think it's because we have a mild climate. It never gets really hot or really cold, because I think strawberries like to have cool weather. If it gets too hot and humid, it sort of melts the flesh of the strawberry. So the farmers have told me that's one of the reasons that they do so well here. They get the kind of cool ocean air and lots of sunlight without the heat and humidity that could damage the berries.
What's the strawberry season in California?
Actually, our best strawberries are probably January to March. And we have them all year long, actually. You can get them 12 months of the year. But in the heat of the summer, probably August, September is when we have the least strawberries because it's just too warm at that point. So it's kind of ironic that we have the best strawberries when the rest of the country doesn't. And when everybody else gets their fresh picked strawberries, it's usually when ours are not the best anymore.
Now, you get California strawberries all over the country. Why do they taste so bad from the supermarket when they're out of season?
Oh, that's such a great question. And I can tell you why. I actually spoke to a farmer called, his name is Ted Thacker, and he runs Thackerberry Farms, which is a pretty popular strawberry farm here in Southern California, and they have local stands where they sell their wonderful strawberries. And what he told me basically is that there are two kinds of strawberries. You have strawberries that are grown for production. And what that means is those strawberries are grown in California. They're picked when they're about half ripe, and then they're gassed, which means that they're treated with a carbon dioxide solution. And they do this to prevent spoilage, so that way those strawberries can remain fresh on that 4 to 5 day truck journey to wherever it is that they're going. So people who live in South Dakota, say in February, can go to their local supermarket and buy strawberries, but they aren't going to taste good, like you said. That's because they weren't allowed to vine ripen. That's the second type of strawberry. The vine ripened strawberry means that it's allowed to ripen fully so that the sugars really have a chance to produce. And the shelf life, in contrast, is only about a day. They're highly perishable because they're so super sweet and succulent. So that's why those berries that you get in the middle of the winter, they may look pretty, but they don't really taste that great.
In your piece for Kitchen Window Online, you talk about the early uses of strawberries in the U.S. and mm-hmm. that they were not as sweet. Is that right?
Yeah. They said that when the European colonists came here to North America, that the native Indians were eating strawberries, but they were wild strawberries. And apparently they were much smaller and not as sweet. And what the Indians would do is they would take those strawberries and they would mix them with a cornmeal into kind of a mush and then bake it almost into a bread. And then once the colonists tasted the bread that the Indians had made, they liked it so much that they revised the recipe and made their own creation using a European shortcake recipe. And that was actually how the American strawberry shortcake was born.
That's wonderful. Then a sweeter strawberry was cultivated?
Right. In the 18th century, apparently they crossbred two different types of strawberries and created what is known today as the modern-day strawberry, which is a much larger, redder, and sweeter strawberry.
Now, I had always heard that the bigger the strawberry, the less tasty they are. Is there any truth to that?
You know, I've heard the same thing, and I'm so glad you asked me that, because I can tell you from lots of strawberry eating experience that that is not true. And I've actually asked a lot of farmers that too, and they said not really, not anymore. Because of advances in technology where they've been able to crossbreed strawberries so many times that they can pretty much determine how sweet that strawberry is going to be, it really doesn't matter that size and sweetness do not necessarily correlate. I've been told that what is more important is actually that it's vine ripened, and that when you look at the strawberry, the top of the strawberry, just before you get to the green hull, they call that the shoulders of the strawberry, to make sure that that is red and not white. That means that it's got more sugar crystals inside the strawberry and that it'll be sweeter.
Oh, that's a very good tip.
Yeah.
We most often think of strawberries in desserts, but
right.
They're also used in savory foods.
Yes. Strawberries are wonderful in savory dishes, particularly in meat dishes. If you use strawberries in salsas, you can pair them with other sweet fruits. You can pair them with mangoes and then put it with onions or a little bit of vinegar so that you have that kind of sweet contrasting with the sourness, like as you would with a typical chutney. And that sweet and sourness really goes well when you pair it with buttery pork, for example, or a nice piece of grilled chicken. And strawberries also go really well with salads. And I like them with particularly spicy salad greens, like arugula or endive, so that you get that contrast between the sweetness and the pepperiness of the arugula.
Mm. In your piece, you say that you can freeze strawberries, something I had no idea that you could do. Tell me about that.
Yeah, actually, it's really easy. What to do is you just buy your strawberries, remove the hull, rinse them lightly and pat them dry, and then just place them on a single layer on a cookie sheet so that they're not touching, and freeze them. And then once they're frozen, you just take them out, place them inside of Ziploc bags, and keep them in your freezer, and you can use them year-round. Just remember, though, that they'll be much softer when they're defrosted, so they're really good for sauces or jams or smoothies.
So do you have strawberries at home right now?
Yes.
And what are you going to have for dinner tonight?
Actually, I am going to have a strawberry salad tonight. I have some fresh arugula and strawberries, and maybe I'll put a little bit of goat cheese and some candied pecans on it.
All right. I'll be right over. Thank you so much, Susan.
Thank you, Bonnie. This was fun.
Here's a statistic for you. Americans eat more chicken than any other kind of meat, on average 87 pounds a year per person. Our next guest has spent a lot of time pondering that statistic and is prepared to make this pronouncement.
Most of the time, people are overcooking it.
So we're a nation eating overcooked chicken.
Bad overcooked chicken.
Chris Kimball says it does not have to be that way. He's the host of America's Test Kitchen on PBS, and he's tested hundreds of chicken recipes for his new cookbook devoted exclusively to the bird. This morning, Chris is going to walk us through one of them, pan-roasted chicken breast with vermouth, leek, and tarragon pan sauce. We're going to start at the beginning. Not quite the beginning. We've wheeled our cart through the aisles of this supermarket in Santa Monica to the poultry section.
We have probably 15 feet of chicken. They are grown to have small legs and large breasts. Everyone likes white meat. So this is just average chicken.
For an above-average bird, Chris Kimball recommends you search out a kosher brand.
Yeah, here's a kosher bird.
Kosher bird has what going for it that the average chicken doesn't?
Well, there's a few things. First of all, they're slaughtered individually by hand. And a lot of people will claim this is not going to increase anyone's appetite, but they're bled out properly, and as a result, the meat is better. So that's the first thing. Second thing is they're salted. Salt and the water get into the meat, adds flavor, and also makes a juicier chicken, because when you roast it, the salt helps the meat, the protein, retain water. And the last thing is salt tends to make chicken a little more tender. So for all those reasons, kosher is a good place to start.
And we choose a couple of packages of bone-in, skin-on chicken breasts. Another tip from Chris, they're more flavorful than the boneless, skinless kind. Let's throw this in. That's it?
Yeah.
Okay, we're set.
Yeah, chicken. I said it's boiled chicken. Any kind of chicken. Boiled chicken, fried chicken, cotton picking chicken. Chicken for me.
All right, let's head for the kitchen. The oven's preheating at 450 degrees, but this recipe begins on the top of the stove in a pan. Start with a tablespoon of vegetable oil in a large skillet over medium heat.
And when the oil just starts to shimmer and a little bit of smoke comes up, that's when you know when the pan's hot. People at home, they don't use enough heat. If you go in a restaurant kitchen, there's a tremendous amount of heat. Because if it's not hot enough, you put chicken in, you're going to steam the food. You're not going to saute it. You're not going to get any browning. Mm. And by the way, when you take something like chicken and put it in a pan, you want to start it close to you and then put it away from you like that.
Safety sake. What is the seasoning on these chicken breasts?
Salt and pepper. That's all we have. You want a lot of noise and you want smoke and steam coming up because we're going to brown them skin side down. This is four individual chicken breasts. Now, another thing is you don't want to check the chicken in the first couple minutes when you put it in the skillet because the skin's going to attach itself to the bottom. See? I knew that's something you did. So you want to give it a minute.
You don't want to take your tongs and peek underneath
see
if it's doing.
I'm not patient.
How it's doing.
So once in a while in the test kitchen, I'll do it. And everyone yells at me. They say I have to wait. So it should start to release. Like this will release nicely. Okay?
Mm, yeah.
Yeah? See?
Nice and brown.
Yeah.
This is splattering a lot.
Yeah. It's messy. It's cooking. It's called cooking. Yeah.
When the chicken is browned on both sides, that'll take about 8 minutes, pop the pan into the oven. That's another 15 minutes or until cooked through. And one thing Chris always insists on, a good digital meat thermometer.
And that we're eating 157, 59,
what are you
60.
What are we going for
61,
here?
165.
Maybe it's overcooked.
Did you say overcooked?
And now for the pan sauce. One big payoff of browning the chicken in a skillet is that you're left with lots of tasty brown bits at the bottom. So we're going to stir in a bit of flour, 3/4 cup of broth, and 1/2 cup of vermouth. And we begin with 1 medium leek.
So now we have just the white part of a leek.
Chopped up.
And we're just going to soften the leek. We're not going to brown it or sauté it.
Don't forget to scrape up the good stuff off the bottom, and don't worry about remembering all of this. You can find the complete recipe at npr.org, along with a couple of others. We're hungry, so let's skip ahead, where we've stirred in butter, whole grain mustard, and fresh tarragon.
It's beginning to look nice and rich. Went pretty quickly from liquid to being almost sauce.
Most people serve chicken. They just serve it plain. And this is 7 or 8 minutes of work. It's very simple at the end.
So far, nothing's gone wrong.
Oh, if we spend enough time together, Renee, something will go wrong as usual. Well, you know, actually, that's funny, but I've learned everything is by making really bad food. I mean, if you make mistakes, that's when you learn how to cook, because you make the mistake and you say, well, gee, you know, why did that happen? And you go back and make it over and over again. So, you know, making bad food is the beginning of becoming a good cook.
Thank you, Chris Kimball, who cooks for us on many a holiday. On this Memorial Day, we've been talking chicken. Chris Kimball hosts America's Test Kitchen on PBS, and his new cookbook is called The Best Chicken Recipes. Robert, have you ever done the chicken dance?
I've spent a lot of weddings avoiding doing the chicken dance. You're not going to rope me into it, are you?
No, I'm not going to make you bend your arms into wings and flap them up and down.
All right, look, I'll do it this once, but if you make me do the Macarena, I'm out of here. Okay, everyone, this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Robert Smith.
And I'm Renee Montagne.